From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet a man whose business is death. Medical examiner Michael Bodden has written a new book that explores the medical facts around some of the biggest crimes of the century. His verdict? That bungled autopsies have destroyed vital evidence. Also today, writer Mary Kay Blakely tells us how a 9-day coma changed her life. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new release of a historic performance by soprano Magda Olivero. And commentator Stuart Brand explains what America gained and what it didn't from the race to put a man on the moon. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. There are some survivors reported in the crash of a United Airlines DC-10 in Sioux City, Iowa, late this afternoon. The jet with 297 people on board went down in a cornfield while attempting an emergency landing. Details from NPR's Wendy Kaufman.
United Airlines Flight 232 was en route from Denver to Chicago when the plane experienced a complete hydraulic failure, a failure of the equipment that steers and controls the plane. The crew attempted an emergency landing in Sioux City, but the plane crashed in an open field about half a mile short of the runway. The plane was in flames and broke into small pieces. One eyewitness said the plane's nose is the only piece of the aircraft that remained intact. This is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
The Iowa National Guard says at least 40 people survived the crash. Among them is Jerry Schimmel from Denver.
We were in midair, and there was a big, loud, booming noise, and it kind of shook the plane. The pilot got on and said that one of her engines had quit, had blown, and then had quit. When it blew, it hurt the tail of the plane so that the pilots couldn't control the plane.
There is no word on the conditions of the other survivors of today's crash in Iowa. General Wojciech Jaruzelski won a narrow victory today in Poland's first free presidential election since the start of communist rule. The National Assembly elected Jaruzelski to the 6-year term by a vote of 270 to 233 with 34 abstentions. That is just one more than the 269 needed to win. By electing Jaruzelski, the National Assembly assured that the Communist Party member would have control of the military and foreign relations. President Bush's modest aid package for Poland and Hungary is getting a positive response from Congress. Barry Schwied reports that after a White House briefing today, approval seems certain.
The package calls primarily for a $100 million fund to promote private enterprise in Poland and a similar $25 million fund for Hungary. House Speaker Tom Foley said there would be strong support for the package on Capitol Hill. Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina is expected to drum up some opposition to aiding communist governments. But the president told reporters on the way home from Europe yesterday he's confident of approval nonetheless. Senator Bob Packwood of Oregon stressed how modest the package is and how wise, Packwood said, for the president to go slow in aiding Poland and Hungary before he finds out if the reforms really take place. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwied in Washington.
The International Monetary Fund today overrode U.S. objections and voted to admit Angola as the fund's 152nd member. American officials cited economic reasons for opposing Angola's membership to the IMF. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 39 points today to close at 2584.41. This is NPR News. The Internal Revenue Service has auctioned the home of a pair of tax resisters in western Massachusetts. The couple has withheld their taxes for the past 12 years to protest Washington's defense policy. Today, they learned their home and their belongings now belong to the U.S. government. Anthony Brooks of member station WBUR has more.
The couple has been urging local developers not to bid on their house since the IRS put it up for auction, demanding $27,000 in back taxes. Today in Greenfield, IRS officials unsealed 90 offers on the property, but all from supporters of Keeler and Corner. The bids included $35,000 worth of food for the poor and community service. None of them was a cash offer, and all were rejected by the IRS, which then bought the 5-room farmhouse for $5,100. Randy Keeler, Betsy Corner, and their 9-year-old daughter now face eviction.
They've told us that this is not the job of the IRS, but the Justice Department. And we, in turn, have assured them that we have no intention of leaving our home voluntarily.
The couple has 6 months to retrieve their home by paying off the back taxes, something they say they have no intention of doing. For National Public Radio, this is Anthony Brooks reporting.
William Lucas today defended himself against a wide range of charges raised at a Senate hearing on his nomination to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. Panel members asked Lucas to explain $8,800 worth of undeclared goods in his luggage. He said he had not been aware of all the purchases his wife and daughters had made during a trip to Japan and South Korea. Lucas faces tough opposition over questions about his credibility and qualifications. Striking miners in Siberia began returning to work today after Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev warned that the week-old dispute could overturn his reform program. Analysts say it would not be possible to say with certainty that the dispute is over until it is confirmed that the miners are back at work. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. Ever since President Kennedy's murder in 1963, there's been a controversy about how the shooting actually happened. Part of the confusion over the number of gunmen came about because Kennedy's autopsy wasn't done properly. Years later, my guest, Dr. Michael Bodden, chaired a panel that tried to recreate the evidence to figure out exactly what did happen to the president. His conclusion was that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Dr. Bodden is one of a small group of forensic pathologists in the United States qualified to investigate unnatural deaths. For 25 years, he was a medical examiner in New York City. He conducted autopsies on victims of homicides, suicides, and fatal accidents to determine exactly how they died. The job required him to be part doctor, part detective, and part politician. Sometimes his findings would create controversies involving public officials or the police. Bodden is now the co-director of the Forensic Sciences Unit of the New York State Police. He's written a book titled Unnatural Death, Confessions of a Medical Examiner. I asked him what he remembers about his first autopsy.
The first autopsy I saw, I was in medical school, and I came down to the Bellevue Hospital morgue, and there was a woman being, as a first-year medical student, was being autopsied, who had suffered burns and died in the hospital. The burn treatment in those days was not nearly as good as it is now. And the first thing I remember is the odors that were so foreign to even having been in the hospital set up at Bellevue and with the ethers and the chloroform. The autopsy odors are different.
Is that the smell of death, or is that the smell of the chemical process?
It's the smell of death in the sense of the smell coming from the body after death, which is magnified in situations in which there are infections, like in this particular case, which is a burned body. The burns had become infected. And I think that's what turns people off most when they come into autopsy rooms. It isn't the Quincy concept of everybody fainting when they see a dead body. That isn't what's so culture shock. The culture shock really coming in an autopsy room is the odors, and the odors that we who work there become used to and become inured to. When I go to an autopsy room, I don't smell anything different than outside in the street, but I found that most people, the great man, their remembrance of their first autopsy room visit is they were put off by the odors more so than what things look like.
How much do our insides give us away? And I'm thinking when you're opening us up, how much can you tell about how we've lived our lives?
I think that our days on this world are implanted into the various organs of our body. Such as cigarette smoking. We tell a person is cigarette smokers and their lungs get black. Alcoholism. The liver tells us a person's been using alcohol. Lymph nodes get enlarged with drug addiction. The skin is a marvelous palette of what happened in life. Needle track scars of drug addiction, old scars of suicide attempts, tattoos. Are a wonderful way of getting insight into a person's lifestyle. So we see lifestyles a lot, and especially so in the kind of cases that medical examiners investigate, about 9% of all deaths in this country are unnatural, and the unnatural deaths, which include the murders, the suicides, the drug addicts, accidents, those are the kinds of death in which what we see at autopsy, prior injuries, prior stab wounds, prior bullet wounds, old evidences of fractures and injuries in the battered child, these tell us a great deal of a person's environment, lifestyle, and in a sense, the real, you know, most doctors speak to patients, and patients tell them verbally where it hurts and what their complaints are. We have to develop this information from what the body looks like, and it's very expressive, the body, but we have to take the time, patience, and have the training to look for all these things, and few doctors are trained that way.
Where do you begin with an autopsy? Where do you make that first incision?
Well, I think, Marty, the question is, when an unnatural death or violent death is investigated, we first should look at the scene of death, where it's been kind of quipped that we, the medical examiners, are the last doctors to make house calls. And we make the house calls at the scene, and we look for indicators of why the person may have died. Empty bottles of booze, suicide notes, evidence of a struggle at the scene. We also, it's also very important for us in unnatural death investigation to get ideas of, was the body moved? How long has the person been dead for this, from the stiffening of the body and the temperature changes and things? So the great deal we learn right at the place where the person is found dead.
Do you look in their refrigerator? Do you look under their bed?
Do
you look in their closets?
Absolutely. The first thing, we look to see if there are any newspapers out the door, to see when the last time the mail was picked up. Most deaths, most violent deaths, the police know right away what the cause of death is from the following the blood splatter along. You know, they follow the blood to the hole in the body. If there's a stab wound or a bullet hole or a battering with a baseball bat, the police know that pretty good. So we're telling them the obvious if as far as cause of death goes. It's other aspects of death that may be contributory, evidence of drug use, alcohol use. The time of death becomes very important in many cases, and that's things like when was the mail last picked up, what's the date on the milk bottle, is there nitroglycerin pills in the bathroom indicating it has heart disease or insulin, or so we look around, we look for medications, we look for many things that can help us in getting an idea of why the person may have died and when the person died.
So when you have the body, then you've taken the body back to the morgue or you're beginning to examine him or
her. One other thing we haven't done yet. At the scene, we also look for trace evidence. And I just pointed out because talking about detecting, when two people come in contact, they leave something of each on the other. Hairs, fibers, even bacteria have been useful in determining where that people made contact. This has been magnified by the whole new developed burgeoning DNA technology, because a single hair, a single drop of blood, a single semen saliva spot can, if properly identified, preserved, and taken the looked at properly in the laboratory, can tell you the genetic fingerprint, the DNA fingerprinting of the perpetrator. Now, these things are lost if the decedent is casually moved about. So our job starts very much where a dead person is found. And then, after all of these things are looked for, time of death, evidences, and they're all taken and preserved, the body is then transported to the medical examiner's office or the mortuary, and then a systematic external and internal examination of the body is performed. Clothing is looked at, the body externally, x-rays are taken, photographs are taken as needed. And then the autopsy itself is kind of like a surgical procedure, mm-hmm, where two incisions are made, and this is traditional around the world. One is from the chest to the abdomen, which permits examination of the heart, lungs, liver, internal organs, and the other behind the ears so that the brain can be looked at. And what happens when it's all finished, the body, through the, since these incisions are made purposefully to permit it, the body to be sewn up, and then the body doesn't show evidences of a procedure at a wake or at a viewing, and a great deal of knowledge can be learned from it.
Is it possible to fool the medical examiner?
Well,
and I guess I'm talking
sure.
about the perfect murder.
Well, when you talk about, there are two kinds of perfect murders. The more mundane but more common is the murder that doesn't get solved. And in this country, perhaps a third of all murders don't get solved. So therefore, about 20,000 murders in this country, and maybe a third, no resolution, so that those are perfect murders. Shootings, stabbings, et cetera. The kinds of murder that's hardest for the medical examiner to detect are two kinds. One is a poisoning murder, because the laboratory, the toxicology laboratory that looks for poisons in the tissue, can't look for everything. And unless the medical examiner has a suspicion that it might be murder, poisons can not be looked for and therefore missed. And you don't even have to get exotic poisonings. Just cyanide could be missed if the medical examiner doesn't alert the laboratory that that's a possibility.
But a very vigilant medical examiner, is there anything, any poison, any substance, any way of death that really is undetectable?
Yes, there are poisons that are undetectable. The problem with poisoning, though, is the poisoner has to get within reach of the victim. So they tend to be family affairs. The frightening thing about the Tylenol cases and the cyanide is that if poisoners are going to poison anonymous people, people that they don't care who they poison, that becomes very difficult to determine, to detect. And that's why we still don't know. That's never been resolved, the Tylenol poisoning. The poisoning of victims unknown to the poisoner creates a problem that has not traditionally been happened when poisons of arsenic used to be called inheritance powder. You know, that's the way you inherited by
you
poisoning
granddaddy.
Right. but I think the more, so we do miss poisons, mm-hmm. but there probably are more internal poisonings that if suspicions arise in other family members or somebody else, they can be looked for, or the bodies can be exhumed. One of the reasons we exhume bodies, disinter bodies, is when suspicions of poisoning come up from history, circumstances, witnesses, or what, after the body has been buried, the body can be disinterred, and most poisons can still be found in bodies that are embalmed and buried.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Michael Bodden, and for 25 years he was medical examiner for New York City, and from 1978 until 1979 he was chief medical examiner for New York City. He's written a book about the whole field of forensic medicine and about his life in that particular field. The book is called Unnatural Death, Confessions of a Medical Examiner. It's published by Random House. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with Michael Bodden, and he was medical examiner for New York City for 25 years. We're talking about the whole field of medical examinations. How much do you like the public aspect of your job? And there is the kind of facing the reporters and the cameras and delivering, you know, a certain kind of information which can turn a case around. And there's even, I suppose, a celebrity aspect to it, too.
I think in general, as far as doctors are concerned, any publicity is not good. But there's some that are worse than others, and partly because traditionally medicine has not been a profession that had celebrity stars. That's changed in the past many years. In the past 20 years, where they have the star surgeons and the star physicians to the stars. Many doctors still look with suspicion at such physician as unfair advertising and things like that. There's a cult feeling in medicine, but I think medical examiners are public community physicians, and the public aspect that permits us to translate our autopsy findings into how to prevent deaths or how to diminish injury, such as one of the things that got me involved in this field early on was I'd go down to the medical examiner's office, see all of these motor vehicle deaths where little kids would be smushed against the dashboard and would have all kinds of very interesting injuries, all dutifully noted and put in the files. But it wasn't until somebody like Ralph Nader, a lawyer, translated it into seatbelts and said, hey, we should have restraint systems in a car, that I realized that we weren't translating our findings to the public as we should. And I think it is an important role for the medical examiner to translate that we have a new drug here that's killing people, cocaine or crack or heroin or what, or that there's a high incidence of suicide in a certain area of town that should be addressed, or alcoholism or wood alcohol is come into the picture. There are lots of ways in which we should be informing the public. I don't like the public politics of being a medical examiner, but I do think that as a community doctor, part of the responsibility of the medical examiner is to translate things to the public to prevent injury and death.
You say that the field of forensic pathology is filled with misfits. Do you include yourself?
No, I don't include myself as a misfit, but I must say that when you have a profession, medicine of 600,000 doctors, only 400 of which are practicing a specialty, that by definition is almost a person who deviates from the normal. but I think that when I started out in the profession, a lot of the doctors who did medical examiner work were alcoholics or psychiatrically impaired individuals who could not do work in more traditional surroundings.
And they preferred perhaps their patients dead or at least mute?
Well, dead, mute, and working for a municipality. It's easier to work for a municipality sometimes than to work in the private sector. And in a sense, the medical examiner's profession got a bad reputation because of that. So that when I went into the field, I was cautioned by my professors, that's not a kind of a thing that a real doctor would do.
I'm curious about what the doctor-patient relationship is when your patient is dead.
That, Marty, that's a very interesting question in the light of all that's coming up with AIDS especially. The traditional concept was that once a patient dies, there's no more confidentiality. There's no confidentiality in the dead body. And anything that we as medical examiners found as to cause of death, tuberculosis, syphilis, suicide, that was public records. Tom Noguchi, who was the medical examiner in Los Angeles, got into trouble with that when he said that William Holden was intoxicated when he died of accidental falls. And that was kind of scary because, in general, the medical examiner's office did release information about alcoholism so that this became alcoholism certainly is a public health problem that has to be dealt with and can only be dealt with if you know the extent of the problem. But more recently, many states have passed laws about, because of the AIDS concerns as to privacy, that any information having to do with AIDS remains confidential, which is difficult for medical examiners to deal with because one often there are police involved and say, Doc, you know, we picked this guy out of the car and got blood on me, or we did resuscitation. Does he have AIDS or is he infected? And in many places, the medical examiner cannot do an antibody test on the dead body until he gets permission of the next of kin, who may not have any idea that the person may be infected. So it gets to be very difficult, and very difficult for law enforcement people who are the people, the police are the people who deal with injured parties whom they don't know anything about. And we can't, our hands are tied in that respect.
I was reading a medical examiner saying that what it takes to do the kind of work that he does is a combination of curiosity and skepticism. Does that fit the way you approach your work?
I think that certainly curiosity is very important. Skepticism also is, because perceptions of what happened to people are affected by guilt feelings, are affected by misinterpretations of violent acts. The eyewitness is notoriously, the honest eyewitness is notoriously unreliable. And we get more, the problems that medical examiners get into in particular is when people die during custody battles with the police. And that's the one area where medical examiners can't adopt automatically what the police say, because it may be in vested interests involved. And in a sense, the medical examiner is the whistleblower. We're the person who says that the police acted with unnecessary force. We're the one who says that the mayor's son was drunk when he got in the fatal accident, or that some prominent person's wife committed suicide. And in that sense, in telling the truth, we step on people's toes. It's going to get even more interesting, I think, more difficult to deal with now with the new abortion laws coming in, because if there's a jurisdiction in which abortion is illegal, then the medical examiner has to more carefully look at any woman in childbearing age that dies, and it's the one area where doctors may not tell the truth. If a doctor does an autopsy and does an abortion and gets botched, he's liable to say, as in the old days, died of asthma or pneumonia, and the medical examiner then has to be suspicious of his fellow colleagues. So the skepticism that you raise is important, and it's the kind of thing that can be divisive between professions and makes the medical examiner, you know, looked upon as the whistleblower.
Have your ideas about death changed at all since the 25 years you've been doing this kind of work?
Yes, Marty. I think in a sense, when I first started, I guess I looked at death more as a puzzle. That is, somebody's died, and now it's a puzzle as to unravel why the person's dead. As years progressed, I've become more interested in not why people died, but how they stayed alive for so long, and the wonders of the human body, and how people riddled with heart disease, cancer, bullet wounds, how the body is such a wonderful piece of art and biochemistry and mechanics that is able to survive such tremendous insults, and how the parts function, and how one looks at a body and in a sense sees God in a body, and it's just the most amazing creation is a human body.
Well, we're out of time, but I thank you very much, Dr. Michael Bodden, for talking with us today.
Thank you, Marty.
Dr. Michael Bodden's book, Unnatural Death, is published by Random House. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, our guest will be Native American writer Michael Doris, along with his wife Louise Erdrich. Doris has written several novels, including A Yellow Raft in Blue Water and Love Medicine. Doris's new book, The Broken Cord, deals with fetal alcohol syndrome. Doris discovered that one of his adopted sons has the disease. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. In 1984, Mary Kay Blakely's life seemed to be falling apart. A divorce, the death of a relative, trouble at work, and an illness that sent her into a coma for 9 days. Coming up, Mary Kay Blakely tells us how that illness gave her the focus to reorder her life. It's the subject of her new book, Wake Me When It's Over. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new release of Francesco Chilea's rarely heard opera, Adriana Lecouvreur. And on the 20th anniversary of mankind's first trip to the moon, commentator Stuart Brand recalls the small part he had in shaping America's space program. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. A United Airlines DC-10 trying to make an emergency landing in Sioux City, Iowa, crashed this afternoon and exploded into a ball of fire. The FAA says 80 people have survived the crash, and there are other reports which indicate more than 100 people survived. Jerry Schimmel is one of the survivors.
Well, we had the plane broke in half right in front of me. I went on the back half of the plane. It rolled over twice, I think, and then it burst into flames, and I grabbed an old lady and a baby, and I went out the plane, and then I looked back, and there were just flames, and I ran into the cornfield and helped other people.
Russell Mack is a vice president for United Airlines. He says the company doesn't know why the plane crashed.
I don't have any details at this time as to exactly what the nature of the difficulty was, but he was trying to make an emergency landing, so he obviously did have serious difficulty.
The FAA says the plane experienced complete hydraulic failure before the crash just after 4 o'clock this afternoon. An administration official says President Bush wants to commit to building a manned outpost on the moon and sending astronauts to Mars. The unidentified official told the Associated Press that the president won't outline a specific proposal tomorrow. Source says the president will endorse the concept of a Moon-Mars mission. The concept was recommended by Vice President Dan Quayle and the National Space Council that Quayle chairs. In Poland, General Wojciech Jaruzelski was elected president today, but only by a slim margin. He received only one vote over the simple majority he needed for the National Assembly. Jane Dobia has details.
Only half the chamber burst into applause when the election results were announced. Jaruzelski was immediately sworn in. He told the National Assembly deputies that he would work with all constructive groups represented among them. He also emphasized that he would like to win the support of deputies who voted against him. Before the balloting, Solidarity spokesman Bronisław Geremek told the Assembly that opposition deputies were withholding judgment on Jaruzelski. Solidarity wants to know if the general will work in the interests of the entire country. Full election results will be published in the National Assembly's Daily Record. That report will show how each deputy voted in today's balloting. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Police in Thailand report at least 11 people killed and 9 others wounded today from a bomb that exploded at the entrance to a provincial courthouse. The bomb was draped over the handlebars of a parked bicycle. It went off just as lawyers and plaintiffs in a civil suit were leaving the building. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up today 39.65 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The composer Francesco Chilea was born in Sicily in 1866, died in 1950, and is remembered mainly for two operas. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a live performance of one of them featuring Magda Olivero.
Isn't a composer I'd ordinarily cross the street to hear. But in 1973, a friend of mine talked me into driving from Boston to Newark, New Jersey for a production of Chilea's most famous opera, Adriana Lecouvreur. or rather, for the soprano in the title role, the legendary Magda Olivero, the singer Chilea preferred over all others in this part. Olivero had been a major star in Italy before she retired in 1941. Chilea himself wanted to see her as Adriana one more time. But when she finally returned to the stage, Chilea had died. It was this second leg of her career that brought her to America. When she appeared in Newark, she was at least 63 years old. "You'd better see her now," my friend advised. "You'll probably never have another chance." Who could have guessed that her career was far from over, that 2 years later, she'd make her Metropolitan Opera debut as Puccini's Tosca? But she never made a commercial recording of Adriana Lecouvreur, and this performance turned out to be her farewell to this role. Fortunately, just as in the movie Diva, someone in the Newark audience snuck in a tape recorder. That performance has just been released by Legato Classics on a set of compact discs. So here's Magda Olivero as the 18th century French actress Adriana Lecouvreur singing, "I am the humble servant of the creative genius," the aria every soprano believes is about herself. Adriana Lecouvreur was composed in 1902, 2 years after Tosca, and they're both cut from the same melodramatic cloth. Both are about stars whose lovers are out of favor with the ruling political powers. Both heroines are destroyed by their own mistaken jealousy. Floria Tosca leaps off a tower. Adriana inhales flowers poisoned by her rival. Chilea's opera isn't as dramatic or as inventively orchestrated as Puccini's. I think it has only two real tunes, repeated over and over. The tunes, though, are pretty and gratifying to sing. Like Tosca, Adriana was a major vehicle for Caruso. The big tenor aria even sounds like the big tenor aria in Tosca. Olivero's tenor in Newark was the young Placido Domingo, and I've never heard him sound more spectacular. He created such an uproar he had to sing one of his arias twice, something the Met would never have allowed. Here's part of that encore.
Thank you.
The sound is obviously not ideal. A nearby seat squeaks louder than some of the singing. But the performance is unforgettable. Olivero was a great diva in the 19th century tradition. Every gesture made a large theatrical point. I can still see her shawl moving to the music as if she had trained it to do that. You can hear the grandeur of her poses in her evaporating pianissimos and swelling climaxes. At 63, she could still give even her stupendous young co-star a run for the roses.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. A year after her divorce in 1984, Mary Kay Blakely was juggling the stresses of being a freelance writer, raising her two sons alone, and grieving over her brother Frank's suicide. She had been recently diagnosed as being diabetic following exploratory surgery. A bad case of the flu tipped the scales, and Mary Kay Blakely passed into a temporary coma. In her memoir, Wake Me When It's Over, Blakely tells us what it's like to be in a coma. Although she was unable to respond to the outside world while she was in that state, she did have some sense of her surroundings.
It's possible that I was nearly surfacing to consciousness, and those were probably the times during which I could hear and I could sense touch. I mean, the people that were with me during that 9 days also told me about stories that they had told that I have no recollection of at all, but I have vivid recollections of some of the stories, and there were periods of time during that 9 days when I felt the most enormous peace. It was more restful, and it was more, I can only describe it as euphoric kind of feeling. I had no desire to return to my body.
When you were in this 9-day coma, where did you go?
Well, my thoughts certainly raced all over the place. A sound or a touch would trigger memories. I would watch these dreams and I would have these recollections, but with a peculiar kind of detachment and peace. It was almost as if I could see my life for the first time because I had no emotional involvement with it. It was only a kind of mild curiosity. And during the coma, I had this, I knew that I was in a hospital during periods of time, and I couldn't remember why. I thought maybe I had been in a car accident, but I couldn't remember the car accident. And I knew that I couldn't see, and I knew that I was paralyzed, but these facts were not at all alarming to me. They were only curious.
Was it kind of like watching someone else's life?
It really was. It was exactly like that.
I was interested to note in your book that your thoughts turned to your family, and that seems to be where, as you were sort of woken up into these dreams or memories, that you went to your family.
They did. My family dominated my dreams, and in fact, dreams about my brother and recollections of his life. And recalling that in a kind of peacefulness was really very useful to me. I really believe that the dreams and the recollections, and certainly the 3 weeks of recovery time in the hospital afterwards, you see your life differently from the perspective of a hospital bed. It alters what you think is important, and I'm actually glad to know this at an age where I'm still able to do something about it. I feel actually lucky to have had this experience.
When others were watching you in your coma, I mean, you describe the kinds of experiences, internal experiences that you were having. What were doctors and friends seeing you were doing on your bed?
the exterior of a coma is certainly frightening to see. My limbs would thrash periodically, and my sister describes expressions that she had interpreted as terrible pain, my face would grimace, and there were procedures that were done to me while I was in the coma, suctioning my lungs, which were very painful. And the family members of a coma patient have to look at something that looks like enormous excruciating pain, but a coma patient doesn't experience that pain herself.
Do you remember waking up or coming to?
I do. I have different recollections. I certainly remember Larry, my friend who was with me throughout the whole 9 days, touching both of my cheeks and bending down to kiss me and saying, "You just don't know how happy I am to see you." I didn't know what had happened. I thought I had just had a very long sleep, and I was suffering a severe cognitive hangover. I couldn't wrap my mind around the word coma. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know that's what had happened to me. I was still immensely disoriented for the next 2 weeks, trying to figure out what had happened. And my first recollection in the hospital, my first recollection of opening my eyes, was hearing people shout my name loudly and opening my eyes just a crack and seeing the fuzzy outline of three silhouettes against, leaning over my bed, shouting my name and holding up their hands, asking me if I could count their fingers for them. And my first conscious thought was, who are these guys and why don't they know how to count their own fingers? I was just irritated.
Did you feel rested?
I didn't feel great, I have to tell you that. It wasn't a wonderful feeling. I felt rested by the time I left the hospital, but it was just astonishing to me how much physical damage had happened to my body in the course of 9 days. I mean, my weight had dropped under 90 pounds, and what happens in coma is that the limbs begin to atrophy. So your hands and your feet begin to turn in on themselves. This is called contracture. And while my coma was only 9 days, it took me an entire week to be able to open my hand, which was in a fist. Mm. So there was, I didn't feel physically terrific. What it did do, though, for the next 4 months is it completely slowed my pace down. And probably for the first time in my life, I felt like I had total permission to recover. The only thing that people seem to expect of me is that I stay upright and conscious and continue to breathe.
I think in the old days, if we can say that, people got sick and then they got better, and they didn't spend a lot of time thinking about how they got that way.
Right.
It's interesting, though, and I wonder that how much of ascribing psychological reasons for physical conditions is really a kind of sign of the 80s. I don't know whether it's good or bad, but I think it's an interesting phenomenon that now every time anyone gets a cold, they're examining the psychological reason for it.
Well, and I think even medical science is recognizing that psychology and emotions play a great role in our vulnerability to illness. Certainly germs are real. They're verifiable. We can see that bacteria can cause and produce certain symptoms. But I think, if an embarrassing thought can cause your face to turn red, and that's a definite physical response to an emotional idea, then I certainly think that we can't ignore that the mind has a tremendous sway over body chemistry. And we're still trying to untangle what's what, what comes first, the emotions or the illness. But, if we can alter our chemistry with drugs and relieve depression, then certainly depression is not simply an emotional disorder. It could certainly also be a physical disorder. Trying to figure out which is which, which requires emotional changes in your life, which requires physical changes in your life. It probably is a symptom of the 80s, but I think it's important to explore that.
How did this coma change your life?
Well, I think I haven't changed the things that I do, but I've certainly changed the way that I do them. I feel so much more pleasure in my life now. And I guess it made me realize, too, that the time that I have to live together with my children is finite. They'll be moving on soon into their own independent lives, and I didn't want to simply be stressed out through this period. I really wanted to enjoy them. They're two terrific people, and I feel the same way about my family and my parents, and I just wanted to make sure that I took the time so that doing things now is just not simply a matter of checking things off on the list, but I do things that give me pleasure.
I'm curious about whether you trust your body or whether, having had this brush with death, you take your temperature, so to speak, more often.
I do. I do. In fact, you know, when I feel myself dragging down or getting tired, I know that I'm vulnerable, and I know, you know, I have extensive knowledge of my body now, and I know what are my vulnerable parts. I know when I get bronchitis or when I get a cold or my pulmonary system is the weakest, and that will respond first. You know, I still have long, long days, but I try not to have too many of them in a row. And yeah, and I guess I take more time to just plain take preventive care of my body too.
Are you afraid of being a hypochondriac?
No, I don't think that that applies in my case. I think I so busily ignored bodily symptoms that now I think a little touch of hypochondria in my case might even be healthy.
Do you miss your coma state?
I think about it often. In fact, I would say that one of the other dramatic changes for me is the whole experience altered my feelings about death. I no longer look at death as a terrifying alternative to life. I think of death now as a really peaceful and maybe even a euphoric state. That's where I expect to go again. I don't, however, feel like I want to go there real soon. I mean, I don't feel unhappy with life, and I wouldn't choose that. But it's just made me feel peaceful about my life, too.
Well, thank you, Mary Kay Blakely, for talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you, Marty.
Mary Kay Blakely's memoir, Wake Me When It's Over, is published by Times Books. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Co-host Noah Adams has joined us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty.
What do you have for us?
On our program from China, a report there, the government is making factory workers take part of their pay, up to 25% in the form of government bonds, redeemable in 3 years. The government there, of course, is desperate for cash and is making this move to keep from printing more money, which would just make inflation that much worse. Also, we'll talk with Michael Shannon, once from California. He's a 19-year-old ballet dancer performing now in this country with the Bolshoi Ballet Company. He's the first American to be accepted into the Bolshoi Academy in the Soviet Union. Shannon's reviews are saying that he is a model Russian dancer.
Okay, Noah, thanks. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Stuart Brand says he inherited his fascination with space exploration from his mother, who back in the 50s was an early enthusiast. To many, the pinnacle of America's space program was 20 years ago, when man first walked on the moon. Stuart has these thoughts on those events and what followed.
Neil Armstrong muffed his line a bit when he hopped onto the moon 20 years ago. "That's one small step for man," he said, "one giant leap for mankind." What he meant to say, of course, was, "That's one small step for a man," which is how it appeared in the newspapers. It was indeed a giant occasion, but 20 years later, we can see it was giant in different ways than NASA expected. From the beginning, the Apollo program was operating on two agendas, one public, one hidden. The hidden agenda was pure Cold War. President Kennedy's answer to Russia's Sputnik was a race to the moon. It was perfect. It employed the Cold War technology of huge rockets. It was a clear and dramatic goal. And Kennedy thought the U.S. could win it. We would out-missile and out-muscle the Soviets, and nobody would be killed, and the whole world would notice. Kennedy went to his science advisor, Jerome Wiesner, for help on the project. Wiesner told him, "I'll make you a deal. I'll help you get Americans to the moon if you'll agree not to call it science." Both men lived up to their bargain. Kennedy emphasized the adventure and quest of it all. He said that humanity had an obligation to explore new frontiers, and America should lead the way. But understandably enough, NASA soon was coming up with all sorts of scientific and technological rationales for the program. If we can get some moon rocks to analyze, they said, we can discover important clues about the origin of the solar system and the cosmos. A couple of years into the moon race, I appointed myself to a bit part in the drama. In early 1966, when I was 28 and easily obsessed, I printed a button that read, "Why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet?" I sent the button to the appropriate people in NASA, the Senate and the House, and the various Soviet science academies. Both nations had been in space for nearly 10 years at that point, and there still was no color photo of the Earth as a whole planet. NASA sent an investigator to see if I was a threat to the U.S. government. His report, I later learned, opined that I was not a threat, and it ended, "P.S., why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet?" Finally, in 1968, before the Apollo 11 landing, astronauts orbiting the moon took color photographs of the home planet, and they were electrifying. So was the landing next year. Kennedy had been right. Landing a man on the moon was seen as a major benchmark of human history, and thanks to television, people felt as if they had participated personally. But Wiesner had been right about the amount of science that would come out of it. The moon rocks turned out to be pretty pedestrian in composition, worth more for their voodoo value as museum displays than as clues to the origin of anything. The Earth photos, meanwhile, took on a mythic dimension. The image of the living, blue, jewel-like Earth rapidly became the icon of the age. Some say the ecology movement began as a direct result. The first Earth Day was in 1970. And the moonshot was a famous Cold War victory for the West. But it soon showed signs of having been an overspecified goal. The race to the moon was over. We won. Everything after the moon seemed like a series of anticlimaxes, even though far better science came out of the relatively cheap robot probes to Mars, Jupiter, Venus, and so on. NASA went into a decline from which it still hasn't recovered 20 years later. Even the photos of Earth dried up. The images you see over and over these days are all from the Apollo program 2 decades ago. Maybe it's time to print up another button which says, "Why haven't we seen any new photos of the whole Earth lately?"
Stuart Brand is founder of the Whole Earth Catalog. His latest book is The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT. Hilary Goldhammer and Marco Cathoria provide the research for the interviews you hear on Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Terry Gross will be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Michael Doris. With his wife, Louise Erdrich, he's written several novels. In his new book, Doris discusses his son's fetal alcohol syndrome. Also, we meet two members of the rock group The B-52s, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Rob Reiner movie. That and more next time on Fresh Air.